You're listening to the Midwest Indie Media Center podcast, featuring the news, views, and opinions of the press peoples, regionally and from around the world. This is the Midwest Indie Media Center radio podcast. Welcome everybody to another wonderful and exciting edition of the Midwest Indie Media Radio. I'm your host, Zach Riot, broadcasting here on the west side of Cleveland, Ohio. And in today's program, we're going to feature many clips from various IMCs from around the world, as well as some news that we're going to hit home here in the Midwest, and also from around the world. So without any further ado, I'm going to go ahead and start the show off with the song.
Slick journalist, I be with my bitch burning splits, building beats out my furnace, topless at these tournaments, pop a clip from my rocket ship while the serpents hiss, preparing to strike like I write for Universal Flicks, a surge of cast rap, but perhaps that's purposeless, scared of just do them, never learn a word in it, my rhyme style fat like two chins, giving whack rappers my two tims, the aftermath of my radio whack, I have you trying to attach new limbs, I go in like a zoom lens, tune in, who him, P-Lock, truant student, war mechanical, rap and blues, Mozart, black music, that's stupid. Fucking, that's what I came to do, and I'ma do just that if it's the same that you can get. Fucking, that's what a brother about, if you ain't fucking, better shut your fucking ass mouth. Yeah, stick with no quarantine, slaps your speaker, now you looking for your warranty. Thorough like TNT, that's always how it's gonna be, the therapy is thorazine, I smoke the best queen off West Stand in Normandy. Okay, I'm ill as a moray and rock shows the war away from here to Oslo, Norway. Throw a Molotov cocktail on your doorway lit if you and yours pop more fake shit. I take on many forms and phases, nasty like porn with the phrases. When I perform my Desert Storm stages, another one torn from the pages of the ages. Superhero on tour in the spaceship. Oh yeah, that's what I came to do, and I'ma do just that if it's the same that you can get. Motherfucker, you should pump your fist and clap your mitts. That's the shit, now who you fucking with? P-Lock, Dumbo, bust a hustle, 50 grand, I'll cold crush you with these balls. I shuffle like a couple jumbos after I rip through Australia and the Orient. I'll be back to bury ya, boy, I'm hurrying. Diamond in the back of my sunroof DeLorean. While you write your life story out with a boring pen, I write Tropic Kaleido, spark live flow. While you wonder if and when my story ends, triumphant trumpets mark my arrival. Upon you, try to rid you of your survival. You know me, gang. That's what I came to do, and I'ma do just that if it's the same to you. To get funky, that's what a brother about. If you ain't funky, better shut your funky ass mouth.
Welcome back, everybody. This is Zach Riot once again. those just tuned in, this is the Midwest Indie Media Radio, and we're back here on this program. Before I go ahead and start off with the announcements, I'd like to thank all those who are listening to today's broadcast and or podcast. We're podcasted through the Midwest Indie Media podcast, as well as through Radio for All. We also have a podcast that you can subscribe to, as well as the Indie Media podcast as well. So we're on a total of 3 different podcasts. Also, for those who may be listening to us through any radio stations, we currently have Berkeley Liberation Radio, who's picking up our station way out there in California, Berkeley, California. And I have a buddy out there, his name is Pete, the local hip-hop artist from our area who actually is residing near Berkeley. So I'd like to give a shout out to Pete's Sake. Big ups to you, bro. How's it going? And without any further ado, we're going to go ahead and start the show with our first bit of news, which comes courtesy of the WTO anniversary events. I'd like to encourage everybody to reclaim the spirit of Seattle 99. Join us for a week of action, November 27th through December 5th, on the 10th anniversary of the WTO protests in advance of the UN Climate Change Conference in Copenhagen. Fall 2009 will mark 10 years since the WTO protests in Seattle, an extraordinary moment when people came together across many backgrounds and issues to raise a single voice against corporate power. In the same spirit, Seattle 10 Plus Organizing Committee, a broad alliance of individuals and organizations, invites all people fighting for justice locally and globally to come together again in the fall of 2009. Actions are being planned in Seattle, and we encourage people to organize events and actions in their own communities. We aim to reflect on and learn from the successes and challenges of our collective victory over the WTO in 1999 and take action in support of alternatives to corporate power. The anniversary comes at a time when a host of key issues, from global warming and financial restructuring to economic justice and healthcare, require urgent action. The political climate favors progressive change more than it has for many years, but we know that change will only come when we stand up and demand it. People are ready to change now. The anniversary of Seattle 99 provides an inspiring focal point to mobilizing our collective call for change. People across the United States and around the world are ready, mobilizing for a week of action tied to the anniversary and to this year's WTO ministerial schedule to begin November 30th, 2009. Climate justice activists are organizing a day of action on November 30th in advance of the United Nations Conference on Climate Change taking place in Copenhagen, December 7th through the 28th. We hope to see a multiplicity of tactics and forums reflecting the diversity of our movements. We also invite you to join our organizing in Seattle to help shape up some ununified events and actions during the week of November 28th through December 5th, 2009. If you or your organization has plans for November 2009, WTO related or not, please let us know so we can coordinate, help, and or collaborate. And that comes courtesy of the SeattleIndieMedia.org. And for those who don't know, Seattle was the first and the original Indie Media. And that's a bit of news, like I said, coming courtesy from the Seattle IMC. Also in the news, we have news on Tariq Mihana. The railroading of Tariq Mihana continues. The U.S. legal system says we are presumed innocent until proven guilty, but Tariq Mihana joins the many defendants who have not enjoy this presumption. In our post 9/11 world, it is a widely accepted notion that devoted Muslims are conspiring to commit acts of terrorism and violence. The legal system, backed by public opinion, can easily hold Muslims for crimes that are connected to this with the defendants with little or no evidence. And Massachusetts is not immune to this pattern. Tariq Mahana, 27, was arrested October 21st during a 5 a.m. FBI raid on his and his family's home in Sudbury. He had since been kept in solitary confinement and at family's home, Plymouth House of Correction. Mahana faces charges of aiding terrorists and conspiring to commit acts of terrorism at home and abroad against civilians and U.S. officials. If convicted, he could be spending the rest of his life in jail. He has pleaded not guilty to all charges thus far. The mainstream media condemned Mahana from the outset, painting a picture of a wannabe terrorist who had tried many times to kill in the name of jihad, but was ultimately a failure. According to the FBI affidavit, Mahana and a friend had attempted to join a jihadist training camp in Yemen in 2004, but were rejected. These claims inspired a cruel mockery from the mainstream press. The AP described Mahana as an incompetent wannabe and accused him of plotting to kill U.S. troops overseas and U.S. officials at home. Now, the Boston Globe and Herald, the local outlets that broke the news, also based most of their description of Mahana on the FBI affidavit rather than attempting to describe Tariq Mahana as a person with a real life. The facts of the case speak loudly enough. Mahana had no prior convictions before his first arrest last year for supposedly lying to the FBI agents. More on that later. But there is no physical evidence that any crime that has actually been committed, just claims. The FBI's most recent evidence is from 2006, but they waited to arrest him until 2008, the day before Mahana was planning to leave the country to start a new job in Saudi Arabia. What case does the FBI have, and how did it come about? Mahana is a deeply religious man, making him an easy target for the FBI and for the mainstream media. As a prominent, highly respected member of Greater Boston's Muslim community, and outsiders could easily be misinterpret him. The FBI seized Mahana's computer, which they now claim holds information on his terrorist plot, as well as his writings, which have been denounced as extremist and calling for a violent jihad. He holds a PhD from the Massachusetts College of Pharmacy, which is related to his job in Saudi Arabia, and teaches elementary school. His students and his community see him as a mentor. On any side note, before I read on in this, I would just like to state that, I mean, this guy is a well-educated being. How can this guy, just out of the clear blue, be considered a terrorist? Let me read on. It just gets much, much more disgusting, my friends. On the inspection of Mahana's blog, iskandrani.wordpress.com, the casual observer may note the peaceful and reflective tone of Mahana's writing, where he mentions jihad and he directly contradicts the extremist attitude of the holy war that has precipitated some violence. Mahana writes on a blog post titled "The Purpose of Jihad" from February 9th of 2009, and I read, in quote, "And this is from the greatest of qualities of Islam, since the goal of the jihad in this religion is not simply to control people or bring them under the submission of others, nor is the goal death and deconstruction, nor is it oppression under the guise of justice, as it is the goal of the wars fought by those who have strayed from the correct religion. And because of this, it results have differed from others, so the results of the jihad of Islam are the spreading of justice and mercy, of goodness and happiness and success of righteousness, and result of others are death and destruction, and enslaving the creation of oppressing them in the regard to their blood and wealth and lives. The Harley extremist calling for violence acts and stockpiling weapons. Mahana preaches the proliferation of justice, mercy, goodness, and happiness. Much of Mahana's writings, while overtly religious, calls for human understanding, peace, and avoiding violence or satanic doctrines. Blog posts aside, the prosecution's only evidence is the 55-page FBI affidavit, which is based on the testimony from two cooperating witnesses. The FBI could easily have used these witnesses to entrap Mahana. The affidavit claims that both their testimonies rely on personal knowledge, including actions of statements by Mahana. The affidavit also relies on testimony from Daniel Maldonado, who is now serving a 10-year sentence for similar conspiracy charges, and whose phone conversations with Mahana for the similar conspiracy charges and whose rereading over and over again. Okay, well, like I was saying, they had Mahana and Daniel Maldonado had a phone conversation, and it was tapped by the FBI, and the two allegedly used code words pertaining to sandwiches that actually meant jihad. I find this funny. I don't know about you guys, but code words for two sandwiches. That actually been jihad. Hilarious. I might be gonna read the rest of this. Yes. I must say I do find this funny. I will note that if you would like to cooperate more on this, you can help too. Mahana's attorney, Jay Carney, stated that we can help Mahana's case by sending emails, letters of support as soon as possible concerning Tariq's good character. We may send these to ATTY, Stephen R. Morrison, email smorrison@carneybasil.com. Or to ATTY, Stephen R. Morrison, Carney and Basil, that's spelled CARNEY and BASSIL, 20 Park Plaza, Suite 1405, Boston, Massachusetts, 02116. And they also have a website. You can visit the website at www.freetarek. It's free as in freetarek.com. www.freetarek.com. And I have one last bit of news. And actually, I'm going to get to a clip coming courtesy of the Chicago IMC. Before so, Chicago has apparently had an anti-eviction campaign. They've launched their own. And with this, they have a successful blockade. And it says here that on Tuesday, the Chicago anti-eviction campaign kicked off its first day with a success blockade at the home of Lenise Forrest, a community member and mother of two. At 9 a.m. on November 17th, supporters began arriving to blockade the house from eviction, and with the increasing police presence circling the block, many people were wondering what would happen next. Supporters were prepared to stand between Lenise's family and the police to prevent the eviction of the family. Then, just as the corporate news arrived, police suddenly and uncoincidentally disappeared. After the press conference, the police stayed away most of the time, and the threat of eviction dwindled. In all, the eviction blockade turned out to be not a clash with police, but instead a great community building event in which people from all parts of Chicago came together in solidarity. Boris is currently still living in her home with her family, but her fight is not over, and she is not the only one. Chicago Anti-Eviction Campaign has requested more people to become involved immediately. They argue that this is a concrete direct action campaign to take the system head on and increase the power of their communities. And with that, I have two bits of news courtesy Chicago IMC. The first bit is about Susan Geithner, which I'm pretty sure a lot of you guys who regularly either download or are listening to this broadcast / podcast via radio or via podcast, you would know the many, many horrible stories about Susan Geithner and what she's done to a lot of protesters. Well, let me start with this. Susan Geithner, prosecuting attorney for the RNC8, a group charged with the crime of helping to coordinate a demonstration against the Republican National Convention in 2008, received an award from the ABA in downtown Chicago. A group of RNC8 supporters were there to greet attendees with leaflets, information, and discussion. And this is produced by Fred Hackler, Chicago Independent Television, which we will be playing audio clips here on Midwest Indie Media. Following that, we're also going to get into some an audio clip of a Palestinian, pro-Palestinian organization that a member of the Chicago IMC is holding. So we're going to play a couple of clips for you guys from the Chicago IMC, and we're going to get back to this program. You're listening to the Midwest Indie Media Radio Hour with Zach Wright.
My name's Lane. I do a lot of RNC8 work, support work in the Northeast and specifically in Philadelphia. So I'm here today because Susan Geithner, who's the district attorney in the Twin Cities, where the 2008 Republican National Convention was, is getting a justice award from the American Bar Association. Now, Susan Geithner was involved in the prosecution and the case against eight activists, the RNC8, who were involved in organizing against the convention and who were arrested prior to the before the convention even began, held in jail for days and charged with conspiracy to riot and furtherance of terrorism. And also had other charges added later, some of which have now been dropped. But we just basically want to say Susan Geithner is the last person who should be getting a justice award. We wanted to drop the charges, all the charges, acquittal for the RNCA and all the other RNCA politically RNC politically motivated arrests.
Saying, you know, we can't have an exchange with anybody who's going in, and you know, I don't think, you know, trying to reason with somebody who's in that frame of mind is usually not, you know, a winning proposition.
Right. Yeah.
So my name is Ben Mansky. I'm an attorney in Wisconsin. I'm a member of the State Bar of Wisconsin and the National Lawyers Guild, and I also am the director of the Liberty Tree Foundation, which is a pro-democracy group that supports people exercising their constitutional rights, as we are doing here today.
Hi, my name is Mike Derschmid. I'm here supporting the RNC 8, eight defendants from the Republican National Convention charges that were filed against them for organizing a protest against the Republican National Convention in St. Paul last summer. And what we're doing here is basically bird-dogging Susan Gardner. She's showing up here in Chicago at the American Bar Association Criminal Justice Section Award Night, and that's here at the John Marshall Law School. And we are basically reminding her, her colleagues, her peers, about what's wrong with filing charges against political dissenters just for organizing people to get into the streets and protest. We've been doing that in this country for 200 years and longer in other places. That is not terrorism. That is not felonies. That is not, it shouldn't be illegal. In fact, it should be encouraged in this country if we're going to have democracy and other silly things like that. Susan Gardner is getting an award probably about now. She must have made it past us, went in the back door, because we didn't see her. But we talked to a lot of her colleagues about informed debate and questions about what it is she's doing. What happened up there is days before the event just started, in fact, the day before, there was all these preemptive raids. The preemptive raids are, you know, the police busting down doors or going after the organizers of the event. These organizers weren't even at the protests that they're complaining about. They're just arrested for organizing it. A legal point called prior restraint comes to mind in my mind here. And Susan Gardner, running for Democratic position for governor up there, is using this as political capital. Well, it's turning into a political liability for her. More and more people are learning of what she's done and what she refuses to. She refuses to drop the charges at this point. So what we're trying to do is get her to rethink her position.
Palestine Solidarity Project is really an organization of Palestinians. It was started by Palestinians with international support and evolved through the years based solely on the needs of a Palestinian committee. Our goal is not to go and save Palestinians or to protect Palestinians, but to do what we can to support their development and empowerment. It's about representing and supporting those people from below. That it's the people; those are the people that are on the front line. It is the people who own the land that is being confiscated, not the guy sitting in an office in Ramallah that can write about it effectively. Those are the people that we need to be working with. From the beginning, they did not. They made some very concrete decisions. One was that they did not want to organize based on political party. And the reason that they did not want to organize based on political party was not that they didn't have their own individual affiliations with political party, but because the environment of Palestine at that time, right after the elections of Hamas taking power and the internal fighting that was erupting, and the hoopla around that internal fighting, made them say, all right, we want to do popular organizing, but we don't want it to be based on political party. They also made a commitment to what we call very specifically unarmed resistance. The term nonviolent, while a synonym perhaps of unarmed, was seen in a lot of communities as somehow passive, and we are anything but passive. But we are unarmed, and we are, and it is popular, meaning that anybody can participate in it. You don't have to have a certain physical strength. You don't have to own a certain thing. You don't have to be a man, a woman, old, young. Anybody can participate in what we do. A lesson very early on that we learned a lot more here in the last couple of years of wanting to build Palestinian base. So not having the organization or social justice organizing in Palestine be dependent on a particular leader or even a set of leaders, one or two or three people that are the ones that are always in the media, the ones that speak English, the ones that have the contacts to the other organizations, because we saw almost immediately that it's very easy to dismantle any kind of resistance if you just arrest that one or two people. Palestine, except for the focus on Gaza, people have really lost an analysis of what the issues are about. It has become, in some ways, narrowed. And so it is only about Israeli military invasions of the level of Gaza, or it's about the wall, or it's about settlements in East Jerusalem. It has become a campaign-oriented movement rather than a liberation movement, which is what it should is. If everything stopped right now, if the Israeli military just stayed in one place and froze for the next 2 months, and the settlements all froze, if we had this dream, this pipe dream of the settlement freeze, and the takeover of East Jerusalem by Jewish populations, if that stopped all right now, none of it does anything to solve the occupation. And until people start supporting not only initiatives of reaction, which are important, and certainly the immediate theft of your land is a mobilizing factor, but also to start talking about, again, reframing this as a Palestinian liberation movement, which is what, again, it is, can be, and should be, we're not working to the highest extent that we could be. We're not just going to be reactive. We are not going to wait for the military to invade, though we certainly do plenty of that. We're not just going to wait until the wall comes and then we'll start demonstrations, or wait until the settlements attempt to expand and then start demonstrations, but to demonstrate, to act politically against what is on the ground right now, because what is on the ground right now in Palestine is a system that is designed in its essence to prevent any solution.
مين إرهابي؟ أنا إرهابي، كيف إرهابي وأنا عايش ببلادي؟ مين إرهابي؟ أنت إرهابي، ماكلني وأنا عايش ببلادي، قتلني زي ما قتلت أجدادي، أنجلا خانون عن فاضي ما أنت يا عدو بتلعب دور الشاهد، المحامي والقاضي، علي قاضي، نهايتي بادي، حلمك انقل فوق معنى آلية، حلمك لآلية تصير بالمقابر أخطرية، ديمقراطية؟ والله إنكم ناسية، من كتر ما اغتصبتوا النفس العربية.
Welcome back, everybody. This is Zach Wright, and you're listening to the Midwest Indie Media Radio Hour. All right, well, we just played a couple of sound clips coming from the Chicago independent media, or the Chicago indie media, that is. And the last one was pretty good, actually. Focused on the Palestine Solidarity Project. And one of the co-founders had a lot to say. And once again, I'd like to give a big ups and appreciation to the Chicago indie media for providing the coverage. And also, I also have some clips coming from the DC indie media, which I'm going to get into a bit. But before I do that, we're going to jump into Minnesota, where Minnesotans joined the Gaza Freedom March. Israel is very aware of nonviolent movements around the world. The boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement that was instrumental in ending apartheid in South Africa, the peaceful marches in the southern United States that held in the Jim Crow segregation, the marches of India led by Gandhi that ended British colonialism. Israel had studied these histories and is working tirelessly to avoid the same worldwide repudiation that could force them to end their occupation and human rights abuses. When Palestinians act with violence, Israel can claim that they react in self-defense. When a peaceful movement breaks out, like the first Intifada, Israel had to scramble to make sure the world doesn't catch on the fact that Palestinians are, in fact, acting nonviolently. With the help of AIPAC and other pro-Israeli groups in the U.S., Israel has unparalleled success at keeping the American public from knowing both how brutal their occupation is and how largely nonviolent the Palestinian response has been. In 2005, 170 Palestinian civil society organizations called for the international community to boycott, divest, and impose sanctions BDC on Israel in order to end the occupation, end the system of legalized racial discrimination, and recognize the right of Palestinian refugees to return to their homeland. Those concerned with the human rights around the world should honor this call, even when it means to, in my case, self-hating Jews. Palestinian human rights workers like Mohammed Othman get arrested and put into administrative detention, where they may languish for years without charges or trial. Israeli Jews who call for BDS lose jobs and are vilified in the Israeli press. But this should not deter us from answering the call for international nonviolent action. The conjunction with BDS are nonviolent demonstrations and marches. The largest march to date is planned for the one-year anniversary of the beginning of Operation Cast Lead, the assault on Gaza, which resulted in 1,400 Palestinian deaths, over 5,000 injuries, and a total devastation of the civilian infrastructure. Gaza, which has been under siege since 2007, plans to welcome 1,000 international marchers with 50,000 Gazan Palestinians in this peaceful demonstration to end the siege and occupation. Simultaneously, 15,000 to 20,000 Israelis will march on the Israeli side of the border. Now, at least 4 Minnesotans will be among those 51,000 marchers inside Gaza. These include 2 Christians, 1 Muslim, and 1 Jew. One of the marchers is a veteran of the Korean War. One of the marchers is a disabled person for whom 5 kilometers walk could pose special challenges. 2 of the Minnesota marchers are engineers. All of the Minnesotans have been educating themselves on the Palestinian/Israeli conflict and have come to the conclusion that it is not a religious dispute, nor that has been going on for centuries and that will continue forever. The Palestinian-Israeli conflict is a dispute about colonialism, land and resources, theft, and human rights abuses. The struggle is for justice, and with justice comes peace. Quotes: I feel strongly that my going to Gaza is important, says Gail Chalby. First of all, I want to show my support for the Palestinians and my objection to the occupation of Palestine and the siege on Gaza. End of quote. Don Su says, "My reason for going on the Gaza Freedom March is simply to do what I can help the people in Gaza and who have been and still are suffering horribly, both physically and mentally, from oppression and injustice. To let them know in whatever way I can that as an American, I support them in their search for justice and freedom." Ohab Chaubi explained his reason for participating in the march. "The Gaza Freedom March is a peaceful and very visible expression of the outrage of the international community about the siege and its solidarity with the people of Gaza." End of quote. The Minnesota Gaza Freedom March participants will be holding a fundraiser and also an educational event on December 6th of 2009 from 4 p.m. to 7 p.m. at the Hennepin Avenue United Methodist Church, which is also an art gallery, at 511 Groveland Avenue, Minneapolis, Minnesota, zip code 55403. We will show the incredible documentary film Occupation 101 and follow this with a panel discussion. Suggested donation is $10, but no one will be turned away. Join us and bring friends for this historic occasion. So that's the news coming courtesy of the Minnesota IMC. Also in the news, I am going to report on a couple of things based out of the DC indie media and are surrounding the area as well. DC resident Michael Wally, three other line crossers arrested. Hundreds penetrate police barricades. Yesterday morning, they came together at the gates of Fort Benning to solemnly remember those killed by the graduates of the SOA. Four carried their witness across the military lines and were arrested on the base. Nancy Gwynn of Syracuse, New York. Excuse me. Tongue twisted once again. Nancy Gwynn of Syracuse, New York. Ken Hayes of Austin, Texas. Louis Vital of Oakland, California. And Michael Wally of Washington, D.C. Michael is refusing to post bail and will remain in custody at least until the trial in January of 2010. Nancy, Kent, and Lewis have been released and will soon be headed back to their communities to spread the truth about the SOA, WHINSEC. You can join them. Keep your eyes out for further updates with messages about their journeys. Following the procession, several hundred activists risked arrest marching into the street beyond the confines of the protest to carry their message of resistance and people power even further. Puppetistas carrying large puppets of six Jesuit martyrs alongside Cackalack Thunder and other drumming groups led a march together beyond police barricades to lift of the spirit of life so as to better remember the work and ideas of those who have lost. Resistencia presente. Or shall I say, resistencia presente. Sorry, a little bit tongue-tied today. But that's not going to stop me from reading this news bit that's also related to this. And this is on the procession and vigil at Stewart Detention Center. This weekend's activities got started on Friday morning. SOA Watch activists joined over 100 social justice and immigrant rights activists in a procession from Lumpkin Town Square to the Stewart Detention Center to call attention to the abuses at this commercial prison, which in the last year have killed one prisoner and hurt many. Prisoners are continuing to participate in hunger strikes to demand better conditions. In a powerful and emotional vigil, survivors of detention centers, family members of detainees, and human rights activists gathered to listen to those families torn apart by raids and forced detention, including the family of one detainee whose three children went in to visit him following the vigil. Many immigrants to the United States are victims of U.S.-sponsored military training and atrocities in Latin America. In our fight to close the SOA, we continue to work towards a world that is free of suffering and violence. We recognize the SOA as part of the same racist system of violence and domination that operates U.S. immigration policy. We ally ourselves with victims and survivors of state violence and their families in an effort to create a better world. And also, reporting from the DC indie media, I have a few sound clips. So here we go. We're going to report into the DC indie media, and we're going to get into some music. And I have more, much, much more to come. This is Zach Ride, and you're listening to the Midwest Indie Media Radio Hour.
On the weekend of November 20th through the 22nd, thousands of people descended on the Army's Fort Benning, Georgia, to demand that the infamous School of the Americas be closed. Although now known as the Western Hemispheric Institute for Security Cooperation, it is still the same school of coups and torture it always has been. In fact, two key figures in the coup in Honduras are graduates of the School of the Americas. Every year, protesters here read out the names of those murdered by the coup plotters and thugs this school at Fort Benning, Georgia, turns out. On November the 22nd, hundreds of the protesters gathered at the gates of the School of the Americas managed to penetrate the base security before four of them were arrested. One of the arrestees was D.C. resident Michael Wally. Michael has refused to pay bail, and it appears that he will be held in jail until his trial date in January 2010 at the earliest. This is not the sort of civil disobedience where people pay fines and feed the war machine. This is the real thing. Truth of it. You imagine what it's like for opposition candidates trying to campaign in that so-called election in Honduras. Imagine if George Bush had scheduled new elections for October 11th, 2001, with only Fox News and Lou Dobbs allowed to broadcast, and riot police enforcing bans on all public gatherings of any kind, with protesters in the street every day being beaten and shot by police. That's what things are like in Honduras. Zelaya, the legitimate president of Honduras, now under siege in the Brazilian embassy in his own country, has called for a boycott of this fake election, and the United States should follow through and refuse to recognize the results. Catholic bishops have been meddling a lot in secular politics lately. First, they bully the House of Representatives into excluding abortion coverage from health insurance under the proposed health care bill. Now, they're holding D.C.'s homeless and poor hostage in an effort to undo the city's commitment to allowing same-sex marriage. They say they will withdraw all D.C. social service contracts if the city permits gay marriage. That means Catholic Charities, which helped Mayor Finney close Franklin Shelter, won't be running any other homeless shelters on city money. Well, guess what? These are paid contracts. And as D.C. Councilmember Catania is saying, they can be replaced. Allowing religious organizations to violate human rights and anti-discrimination laws with taxpayer funds is a threat to the principle of separation of church and state. Those who accept contracts to spend city money agree to follow the city's human rights code. They can't discriminate against a mixed-race couple like that official in Louisiana did, and soon they won't be able to discriminate against same-sex couples on the city's dime either. It has also been mentioned in the past that the Catholic Church is in a uniquely poor position to whine about gay marriage, given their history of problems with pedophile priests.
I eat more chicken than any man ever saved.
Celibacy doesn't work inside their priesthood, and they are fools to propose it as an alternative to gay marriage, or for that matter, as an alternative to the traditional gay lifestyle. The men don't know, but the little boys understand. Despite their internal problems, and in spite of the First Amendment prohibitions on establishment of religion with state funds, the Catholic Church is pulling out all the stops, both to destroy a woman's right to choose and to burn gay marriage at the stake in D.C. Make no mistake about it, this is a test of the power of the Church to bully a secular government into enforcing their beliefs. Just before the November 19th hearing on Empower DC's public property bill to limit the sale of public property to private developers, needed to control a wave of sales of DC land to Fannie's developer friends, DC Councilmember Mary Che gutted the bill. At the hearing, the original Harry Thomas bill that Empower DC had supported was nowhere to be found. Mary Che stripped out all enforcement, all community notice, and the requirements for master facilities plan. She removed enforcement provisions giving residents standing to sue. She removed the provision voiding all non-complying dispositions. She removed the requirement for mailed, radio, and TV notice for neighborhood hearings, and so much more. At an earlier meeting, Councilmember Tommy Wells had gone so far as to say the bill was not needed because the city could always use eminent domain to get more property. Empower DC members on hand for the markup and for the Committee on Government Operations and the Environment were not impressed by this sham bill.
The further point was this was the original part of the bill.
Right. Excuse me, Mr. Thomas. The people in the audience, would you please observe the court?
Welcome back, everybody. This is Zach Wright, and you're listening to the Midwest Indie Media Radio Hour. Just look at the time, folks. I am nearly out of time as we speak. I have only about 5 minutes or so. Just a last quick comment that I do want to say is that in Seattle and all across the world, there will be protests on the upcoming round of the WTO meetings in Geneva, Switzerland. And these talks are scheduled to take place November 30th through December 2nd. And this is 10 years to the day after the Seattle gathering. Now, for all those who go to these talks, and basically if you're wondering what these talks are about, is that the government officials and corporate lobbyists are going to be out promoting the expansion of business as usual trade policies as a solution to rather than a cause of the global economic and environmental crisis. The commemoration also coincides with the International Day of Action on November 30th in advance of the United Nations Conference on Climate Change taking place in Copenhagen December 7th through the 28th. Well, December 28th, the 7th through the 28th in Copenhagen. That's where gonna the meetings, the United Nations Conference on Climate Change will take place. Alright, well, I'm gonna go ahead and get out of here. I just wanna say up the rebels. And let's all rise up to our oppressors. Zach Wright of the Midwest Indie Media Radio. I'm out of here.
Sometime, what better place than here? What better time than now?